Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Rand Dugas and Heather Fowler. Today, we are delighted to feature Erin Flanagan, author of Come With Me, published by Thomason Mercer.
Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having a cocktail while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a great idea. Today, we are drinking the Rule Number 6, inspired by Erin's book. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
Erin Flanagan won the 2022 Edgar Award for Best First Novel by an American Author for her first novel, Dear Season, and was a finalist for the McCavity Award for Best First Mystery and the Midwest Book Award in Fiction. Her second novel, Blackout, was a June 2022 Amazon First Reads pick. She also has two short story collections, The Usual Mistakes and It's Not Going to Kill You and other stories that were published by the University of Nebraska Press. She has held fellowships at Yaddow, McDowell, the Sewanee Writers Conference, the Breadloaf Writers Conference, UCross, and the Vermont Studio Center. She contributes regular book reviews to Publishers Weekly, among other venues. Erin lives in Dayton, Ohio, with her husband, daughter, two cats, and two dogs. She is an English professor at Wright State University. Her most recent novel, Come With Me, came out in August 2023, and as author Julia Dahl says, quote, Come With Me is a deliciously dark thrill ride about toxic friendship, grief, and the stark and dangerous difference between our true self and the face we show the world. Erin Flanagan is without a doubt one of the best crime writers working today, and her latest takes us inside the corporate world, unearthing the ugly reality of what women in business must sometimes do to succeed. A thoroughly satisfying, thought-provoking read. End quote. What great praise.
Thanks to Julia for that.
Gwen Manor is a widowed single mom returning to her Ohio hometown with her daughter. And thanks to former acquaintance Nicola Kimmel, this is the start of Gwen's new and promising life. Nicola's secured Gwen a lucrative job, rented Gwen a house on her same street, and won the heart of her daughter. But she almost seems too good to be true. She's so selfless, so charismatic, and so take charge. Gwen is sure Nicola is yearning only for someone to get close to. After all, according to Nicola, her marriage is falling apart and her best friend just up and left one day. But how well does Gwen really know Nicola? What does Nicola ultimately want? As their lives become more intertwined and Nicola's grip tightens, Gwen begins to think that Nicola isn't helping Gwen and her daughter, but vying for control of every aspect of her life. And the consequences may be deadly.
How are you doing today, Erin?
Oh, I'm so good. Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome. Great. We're really looking forward to talking with you about your work, but also having you give us a reading a little bit later. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
I do. I feel like there haven't been as many since COVID, so it's always a real pleasure.
Yeah, I know. That was one of the things I missed. That's one of the reasons, actually, we started the podcast, right, Heather?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Because we like hearing people read, and we couldn't do that until we started to get that to come in different formats, right? With Zoom and podcasts and all of that sort of thing.
Definitely.
It's funny because I started listening to so many audiobooks during COVID too, because I would go on these long walks and I found it so comforting to just have an author tell me a story or a reader. So this has become such a love.
Yeah, for sure. So how did this book come to be? I'm curious where you got the idea for it. And also, at what point did you come to the decision to structure the book as you did, with the alternating point of views, the changing timelines, and the rules?
Yeah. So I'm happy to say that this book came out of some really great friendships in my life. No, it was funny. My writing group, we were set to go on a retreat on Friday morning. And Thursday night, I heard from my agent that my most recent idea for a novel was going to be a no-go. And she's like, so get to work on something else. And I had been planning on writing that book and getting it started for the weekend. And so I arrived. I had no idea. I had nothing. And I was just in tears. And this group of women, they were like, you've got this. You're going to come up with something amazing. And we started talking about how we all were at a point in our lives where we had found our girlfriends. We had found the women who were going to support us and lift us up. And that we all would do anything for each other. And we had put some of those crazier friendships behind us from when we were younger. But we started talking about them and we realized we all had some stories. We all had an experience of a too close, too fast friendship. And one of my friends, Katrina Kittle, said, I think you should write about this. And so I'm like, So I started sketching it out. And by the end of the weekend, I had a pretty good idea of what I thought the book would look like. And I loved that it was because of those women. Of course, the book ended up looking nothing like that. But I felt really good at the end of the weekend. So you asked about the structure. And it's funny because point of view wise, I knew that Gwen would be pretty much the protagonist, but that I wanted some Nicola chapters in there. And as I wrote the book, Gwen's voice came pretty easily to me, but Nicola really hid. And I had to write her from the beginning to the end three different times before I cracked her voice. It was, first of all, everything she was thinking. And then I was like, oh, she'd be funnier if she would say these things. So then it was everything she was saying, but I still wasn't understanding her. And it wasn't until I went back to her childhood that she started to make sense to me as a character. And I thought, oh, okay. So there's going to be a different timeline in here too. As for the structure of the rules, I have heard from so many readers that they really love that. And I can take no credit. So that totally bums me out. But my editor was the one who came up with that. I had the rules in there, but she was the one who was like, I think that when we get to the rule, don't look back, we'll have no more from the past timeline. It'll just be like, go, go, go from there. So she was just instrumental in figuring out what the book would look like. And that there's no greater joy to me than having an editor that I really trust and vibe with and who knows how to make the work better.
That's great.
Isn't that true? Mm-hmm. It's like night and day. And then if you find that person, you want to follow them around for the rest of their life and be like, here's my next book.
I know. I'm like, Jessica, do you want to look at my grocery list? I feel like you could get me in and out of Kroger 15 minutes faster. She's so good. But it really is this trust thing. And I think I say this in the acknowledgments that I never want to be the smartest person working on this book, but I wish I wasn't quite so low on the list. There are just so many brilliant people helping a book come to being. But Jessica Tribble Wells was definitely at the forefront of that.
What a blessing. That's awesome.
It was.
I really think it's fascinating and interesting that you have this childhood trauma and family dynamics and such a strong factor in this book, especially with regard to how sociopathology works or can arise. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering while I read it, is psychology an interest of yours?
Is in very much a layman's way. I love those true crime documentaries and podcasts and figuring out what it is that makes people tick. And when I started the book, I felt like I knew Gwen. I'm also more insecure than I wish I was. I too often think somebody else knows better than I do. So she was somebody I understood. And Nicola was the one that I really had to figure out. And I didn't want it to be something like she was just sociopath or something like that. I really wanted her to think that she was doing the right thing in some ways, maybe to an extreme, but that she really was in her own way trying to process something and help Gwen until it became apparent like her own needs were taking over that. But one of the things I was really conscious of in the book is I wanted her to have a character arc as well, where she also gets some relief by the end of the book. And some processing of that past.
Yeah. Well, how did you even get into the thriller genre when you started writing? And I'm curious also, what is the most challenging part of writing thrillers?
I got into them haphazardly. So I wrote Deer Season, which is a pretty quiet mystery. It takes place in rural Nebraska in 1980s. And that one, I wasn't able to find an agent. So I ended up going with the University of Nebraska Press, which it published my two collections and I had a wonderful relationship with. And I was absolutely thrilled to have a novel with them. But then when I started my next book, it was clear from the beginning that Blackout was going to be what I guess would be called a higher concept, that there was kind of a hook to it that Deer Season didn't have. And with that, when I was able to find an agent, we were able to sell the book pretty quickly. And again, it came down to working with an editor. I think when I submitted that book to my agent and then when it went out, it could have gone many different ways. If I'd had an editor who was more interested in women's fiction or book club fiction, it could have had more focus on the family drama. But because I ended up going with Thomas and Mercer, and they focus a lot on thrillers and mysteries and crime, it was pushed further that way. And for me, that was such a fun experience to see, again, how the book grew once it got into Jessica's hands, but also how different a book can be based on somebody else's input and vision. And what I really loved about working with her is watching the screws tighten more and more and more in revision to get that kind of faster pace, that thriller feel to it. And that's one of the things I think I still like is really a challenge for me out of the gate, is to try and write something that's got the right pacing, the right momentum. And with Deer Season, it would be more of a quiet look or somebody thinking something and in Come With Me, people are taking action. Like you're putting people in a situation where they're in danger based on the plot rather than the danger has happened and they're trying to figure out what the mystery is. So once I got into thrillers, I was like, oh, I do not want to look back. Like I love that so much. And I think it is partly because it's such a challenge for me.
Yeah, that's interesting. And also, it's a direct contrast, right? To write something that's more plot-centric and action-forward than you would generally see in if you're writing literary fiction, where people can like sit in the same room for 50 pages or something. So I'm sure that's exciting and fun.
It is. It is really fun. And I started out in literary fiction. My collections are definitely in that genre. And it's funny because I wrote four novels before Deer Season. And finally, I was like, I do not understand plot. I could not figure out like how to move a story fast enough. And I had a different agent at the time, and she had sent three of those books out and nothing sold. And so I was like, I got to figure this out. So I started reading mysteries and thrillers. I had read them somewhat, but I decided that was going to be my focus of reading and see if I could just absorb plot more. And I bet I read those for, I'm still reading them, but I bet it was like 5 years. And then I started writing Deer Season. And I was like, oh, you mean there's got to be a crime? Something's gotta happen. And like once I figured that out, then the book started to work. But I think really it was that one of the reasons I started with a mystery was I'm like, oh, I've got to have a plot. Embarrassing how long that took me to figure out.
Yeah, for sure. And I know that for myself, when I took this professional program in screenwriting at UCLA, that changed the entire face of how I was thinking about plot, because I had 170 pages of a novel. And I'm like, oh, I can write a movie based on that. It's great. And then they're like, yeah, you got about enough for act one of a movie, but we need to throw more coconuts at your protag.
That's interesting. That's so funny. Yeah, you'd think 170 pages. I got 10 movies. Like screenplays are short. Yeah, well, it's really short.
My work is really thoughtful and philosophical, okay? It's really delving. No, yeah, but it makes sense. And I think that once plot occurs to you as more of a driving agent, it's night and day what the difference is and how you can start. Structuring stuff. Fabulous. Well, I'm also interested because Rand and I are often focused on particularly issues with female characters and the way that women writers are doing things in books, particularly relationships with women. And that was something that was so central and cool about this book is how closely it focused in that direction. I wanted to know, in terms of, it felt to me like the idea of motherhood and how it's so primary for the female characters in the book was really important. Did you feel that mother-daughter relationship or something like that was something you were going to be focused on so intensively when you started writing this book?
I didn't think of that consciously. I was more interested in the friendship between the two women. And part of that was that I was single until into my 30s before I really had a serious relationship and then got married. So for those formative years, my relationships with women were the forefront of my life. Those were the people I went on vacation with. Those were the people who I called in the middle of the night crying. And so it had always been really a focus for me. And that sometimes you would be in a relationship that wasn't working, but you couldn't break up the same way you could in like a romance. So like that was what I thought I was focusing on. But I do have a daughter and a stepdaughter. And I think that works its way into my work, even when I'm not really conscious of it, that I'm so focused on that. And I've had a lot of readers come back and say, oh, it's not just Gwen and Whitney, it's Gwen and her own mother. And then Nicola and her sister and her mother, that those all end up being so much at the forefront of the book. But I hadn't really thought about that. I think that's just something I live and breathe so much that I don't think of it in that conscious way, but I'm always happy to focus on it.
That's interesting. I want to talk a little bit more about the concept of friendships. And like you say, they're so important that for some people, that's an even more important and long-lasting relationship than romantic relationships sometimes. And in choosing to write about a friendship, you also reveal how those relationships shape our identities. And it's interesting that Gwen was really focused on her relationship with her husband and not a lot of friends, like not thinking really about that until she met Nicola. And without giving anything away, I was just curious, can you talk about how a friendship shapes the identity of Gwen or Nicola in the book?
Well, I think with Gwen, she was brought up to think that your relationship with your husband or your partner is going to be central to who you are. And then I kept thinking as I was starting the book, like, how can I make this a little bit harder on her? So as soon as she gets married, they move to a town where she doesn't know anybody. So she has to build up friends from there, which you can do. But then they had a baby not too long after that. So then she was home with the baby all the time. And then COVID hit. And so I just kept tightening the screws. And I think she's the type of woman who doesn't want a lot of conflict. So if things are going well with her husband and her home life, and she's an introvert, then she can feel pretty safe in that. She doesn't have a lot of outside conflict to worry about. And she's content with that. But then once all that gets taken away, she starts to realize, oh, I need more of a support system. And I think it's something, once she starts hanging out with Nicola, she realizes she missed a lot too, that that is something central to her life, that there was more beyond her romantic relationship, and that maybe that hadn't been quite everything she thought it was either, that she hadn't had a lot of back and forth with her husband, a lot of give and take. It was more him also being controlling, but in a somewhat benign way. So I think that she had to have a friend like that to realize, oh, that's something I miss. And one thing I really wanted for the book, and I don't think this is giving away any spoilers or something, but I wanted to look at this as a somewhat toxic relationship, but also a complicated one, that even if Nicola is trying to get control of Gwen's life, she's also teaching her things. Gwen's stronger by the end, right, in a way that I don't think she would have been without Nicola. And that's not something to sneeze at. All of our relationships, I think, good or bad, make us who we are. And we can find a lot of strength in adversity.
Oh, for sure. And the other thing is, too, what would Gwen have done if she didn't get that help at the beginning of the book? It seemed like she was floundering. So I agree with you. That was a lovely element of complexity there. What did they give? What did they take? That kind of component.
I think
I liked that. And I also think that class issues are key to this narrative. So like feeling empowered, or just empowered by what future you can have based on your upbringing and the amount of money in your house. I really like that. I liked that element. Has your writing always been interested in issues of class?
I think it has, but I wasn't really aware of it until I went to graduate school and then thought about it. It's embarrassing to say, but I grew up in a small rural town in a farming community. And so class wasn't something I was really conscious of. We were a level playing field in that way. And then when I went to college, I was still at the age where I wasn't thinking in these larger systemic issues. I was like, they have more, therefore I am less. It wasn't thinking in the larger picture. But the more schooling I took, the more I broadened my horizons, the more I realized, wow, this is at the base of so much of my identity that I hadn't really thought of. And I think it's always interesting when you can look at issues like that in such a broad way, when you would not, all you had thought about it was through your own kind of lens. So it is something that I think about now when I'm putting together a story, mainly because it comes down to, sadly, a lot of times the have and the have nots. And depending on where you are in that equation, it really sets up everything.
Yeah, that's true. It really is. I want to go back to, you mentioned that you did a whole lot of reading in this genre, and I'm curious about what books in particular influenced you, or which ones you really liked or that were helpful.
When I started reading mysteries, my gateway drug was Laura Lippman, and I just went bananas for her. I read everything she wrote for, going all the way back. I have just really loved her work. But from there, it just opened up. I remember getting a list of Stephen King, who I love, Stephen King's like top 10 mysteries or something like that. And I read through that list and it just really expanded. And soon I was able to find, these are the authors that I'm most drawn to. Megan Abbott. I think I got to her from, it was like 6 degrees of Laura Lippman for a long time, but I got to Megan Abbott. And from there, I just kept going and going. And some of the authors I love now are Laura McHugh, Julia Dahl, Dench, Rebecca MacEyes, I Have Some Questions for You is one I read recently. I've just had a really great run lately, it seems. But Bright Young Women by Jessica Knoll is a book I just read that I really loved. So I can only remember Laura Lippman, and then it's this gap of 8 years of reading. And then here are the last four books I read.
That's better for me. I can't even remember the ones I read last month. So you're good.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
I would like to know, how long did it take you to actually write this book from first notes to the end? And basically, what was the journey of readying it for publication? How long did that take? Tell us a little bit about it.
So I am a pretty compulsive note taker as far as how long I'm working. I like to set timers. So I can tell you exactly that it took me 360 hours to write the book. Sure. And that was over 6 months. It was the first time I'd written a book under contract. And I pitched the idea. They took the idea. And then I got to work. So I knew I had to write it somewhat quickly. But because I've been taking all these notes, and I would say, oh, a novel would be first draft, 1 hour. I wrote 1,000 words. Or whatever. So I knew that it took me about an hour to write 1,000 words. And I knew I wanted to have a draft done in 2.5 months. So I was like, okay, I write 1,000 words a day. So I got the first draft done. And then for me, that's where the real work started. So the first draft was like, I think 88 hours. And then the rest of 360 was spent revising. And then in that, I had my husband, who's a great reader. He's an English professor. He read a copy and I went back, revise. And then I gave it to Jessica, and then she had her notes, revise. So it was 6 months, but 360 hours.
Wow. I don't think a lot of people know that exactly. That's so interesting.
That is intense.
Here's the thing. So this is always my piece of writing advice for people, is to track your time and task, like how long you're working and on what you're working, so you can go back and do something with that data. So for Blackout, which was my second novel, that was the first book where I had recorded all of this. And I just happened to do it because I have a Google Doc with one of my writing friends. And we've done this for a long time, just as way of being accountable to each other. So I'm like, oh, she's writing today. Good job, her. So that's why it started. But then I was like, what can I make of this data? So when I finished Blackout, I looked, and that one was 497 hours. It was a more complicated book in some ways. But what was interesting to me was it took 22 hours, but the first draft was 13 months of that, but it was only 18% of the hours. This is a lot of numbers, I realized. But once I realized that, I was like, oh, I hate first drafts. I will do anything to avoid working. Because I'm like, it should not take me 13 months to write for 90 hours.
So then you were like, no, I'm going to push myself on the first draft now and knock that out.
Yes. And I don't think the quality was any different. I think it was just every day I was like, just do 1,000 words. They're going to be awful. It's fine. That's what a revision is for. And once I accepted that, I was good to go. So the book I just started revision on, it took me 3 months because I'm like, 1,000 words a day.
That's awesome.
Wow. Speaking as someone on their sixth edit of a 90,000 word novel, I can tell you. Yeah.
And that's the thing too. Revision is where it's at, right? I think everybody thinks, oh, you just write a book and it's like what they pick up in the store. And I'm like, oh no, that's 20% of the book, or the first draft is 20%. All the work for me is revision. And that's the fun part.
Yeah. And then once you already wrote the book, you know the story and you know the character so much better. So you can let that inform earlier bad choices. And so it is, it's a very analytical work coming back through it, making it better and making the sentences cleaner and more beautiful and just like all of the things that are wonderful with that. This is awesome. I actually loved your time discussion. I think that's fabulous. And we are looking forward to hearing you read an excerpt from your book today. But before we do that, let's have Rand tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book.
Today's booktail cocktail is called Rule Number 6. We're calling it that because there are 5 rules made by Nicola in the book. So we thought it would be a fun idea for a drink. The recipe's on the blog if you'd like to make it and enjoy it while you listen at home. Here are the ingredients. 2 ounces of bourbon, or you could use 0-proof bourbon or tea if you're alcohol-free. 2 ounces of unsweetened cranberry juice. 1 ounce of rosemary or regular simple syrup. A squeeze of fresh lemon juice. Mix all ingredients in a shaker with ice. Shake until mixed and pour into the rocks glass filled with ice. And you can garnish with a rosemary sprig.
This cocktail looks so delicious, I can hardly even stand it. So just I was showing it. Oh my gosh. I was showing it to my family last night, and we're making it tomorrow. We were
good. I hope you'll like it.
Well, I think we're good. We had already planned, like, my parents just moved to town and we're doing steakhouse dinner, like cream spinach, baked potato, good steaks on the grill. And I'm like, I got our cocktail covered.
That's great.
That sounds awesome. Can we come? We'll be on our
phone. Yes, absolutely.
Erin, would you like to tell us a little bit about the passage you'll be reading for us today?
So this is from relatively early in the book. It's chapter 5. And Gwen's husband has died very suddenly. And she has found out he has reinvested all of their finances in his tech company. And basically, he's left her broke. She has been out of the workforce now for over 10 years. And their last time she had a line on her resume was when she was an intern in college with two other women. And she's going to call one of them who is still at the company and see if she can get a reference. So I'll start there.
Sounds good. Take it away.
Gwen punched Nicola's office line into her cell and listened to it ring once, twice. The call answered halfway through the third ring. Nicola Kimmel's office, a chipper voice said. Gwen explained she was an old friend who'd worked with Nicola when she started at DAX, that she was getting back into the job market. She tried to remember corporate buzzwords that Todd had used. Was circle back still a thing? Okay, the woman said, but I mean, you'd be better off talking to HR. Of course, Gwen said, feeling foolish suddenly for having called. Who started with the second in command of a major corporation? I wasn't calling so much for a reference, she lied, but just to connect and say hi. Let me see if she's in, the woman started, and just like that, Gwen was on hold, her cheeks flaming with embarrassment. She was debating hanging up when the line clipped from music back to a voice. Gwen, the voice on the other end said, and she knew instantly it was Nicola, her somehow posh yet tough accent that wasn't placeable in the Midwest. Nicola? Nicola let out a laugh. I thought that was you. My assistant said you rang and I almost couldn't believe it. Where are you these days? Gwen was a bit taken aback by Nicola's friendliness. She remembered her differently, more focused and closed off. But that's what 10 years of worn memory tape would do for you. Plus, they were in their 30s now, completely different people. All of their cells regenerated nearly twice in the space of all those years. Hello, Gwen said in return. And for the first time since Todd's death, felt something like optimism. She explained she was in Boulder now. My husband just passed. She paused for the shock and pity before the person on the other end of the line barreled on with an apology. Ugh, you're so lucky, Nicola said. And Gwen was so caught off guard, she laughed. For a month, everyone had been doling out the same tepid condolences, and such a black-humored comment surprised her. More than surprised her, it had made her genuinely guffaw. Watch what you wish for, Gwen joked back, but instantly felt bad. She'd never wished Todd dead. She might have wished him to be more communicative or complimentary or trusting of her abilities, but never had she wished it for him gone. And the sting of remorse flashed through her at the joke. You're funny, Nicola said. I didn't remember that. Despite feeling guilt over her comment, Nicola's compliment was so unexpected, tears filled Gwen's eyes. Since Todd's death, she'd been only a widow, and that someone saw her as a woman with a personality felt like walking into sunlight. Oh God, you're thinking about moving back to Ohio, aren't you? Nicola said, and in July, no less, when it feels like we're living in an armpit, a hairy one. You're really selling it, Gwen said, and Nicola laughed again. Maybe Nicola was right. Maybe Gwen was funny. Moving back to Ohio from Colorado hadn't really occurred to her. She was calling merely for a reference, but perhaps that was an option. In the past week, she contemplated all kinds of things that she thought were behind her. Using fans instead of air conditioning, store brand shampoo, green beans in a can versus fresh. Already, her mind was chugging through possible advantages, like her mother watching Whitney after school. But yeah, she added, I might be. She'd always loved Boulder, the mountains, the hippie vibe. But since Todd's death, everything was a reminder of what she'd lost. The trails they used to hike together, she'd now have to hike alone. The restaurants they loved, she couldn't bring herself to visit. Even now, standing in the sunny kitchen and looking out at the deck, it was so easy to imagine Todd flipping burgers or moving the sprinkler or lounging in a chair with an Avery IPA in his hand. Still that carefree boy from the library she'd fallen in love with. Gwen felt a pang of missing Todd so strong her stomach cramped. She and Whitney seemed to be circling each other in their grief, unable to break the cycle. Maybe what they needed was a change of location, a fresh start, a chance to blow the stink off, as her mother liked to say. Any work lined up? Nicola asked, and Gwen was so grateful for the opening she nearly wept. Play it cool, she thought to herself. I'm just starting to look at my options. I remember you being such a hard worker, Nicola said, and Gwen wondered if she was confusing Gwen with Missy, who had been a hard worker. But she wasn't about to contradict the only contact she had in the business world. Yeah, I really loved working at DAX. Well, I wouldn't go that far, Nicola deadpan, and then laughed again. But listen, I'm sure you'll have loads of offers wherever you end up. But if you happen to be in Dayton, I'd love to set you up for an interview, maybe in accounts. We've always got something available there. It's been crazy turnover since COVID. Really? Gwen said, hope rising in her chest. That'd be great. Until this call, moving back to Ohio hadn't really occurred to her, but she felt it now in a rush of wanting. This job, this move, they could be the answers. Sure, and listen, Nicholas said, why don't you email me your resume in the meantime and I'll see what I can do. Nothing wrong with options, even if they're entry level. And if anything, maybe we can make you an offer and you can use it as leverage to get more money somewhere else. Gwen was speechless. She had received so much kindness over the past few weeks, but it had been pity in disguise. Friends had been good about dropping off casseroles in the beginning, but the food had been baked in disposable aluminum pans, so they wouldn't need to return to the house of suffocating grief. Gwen's mother, Jerry, had told her once that when Gwen's father died, it was like the world had cast her in a cold and invisible shadow. Gwen understood that isolation too well now. This felt different, like someone trying to help her because they liked her. Seriously, Nicola, this means the world. Thank you. We interns need to stick together, she said, like it was no big deal. Speaking of, Gwen said, are you still in touch with Missy? Nicola paused. Who? Her voice had shifted a vibration, like a change in cabin pressure, and for a brief second, Gwen wondered if she'd imagined it. The other intern? Oh, right, Nicola said. She worked here until a few months ago and left under weird circumstances. Gwen did the math. That would have been around March. It's not really something I want to go into right now. Oh, of course, Gwen said. I'm sorry. No worries, Nicholas said. There was another pause, and then the air pressure returned to normal. Gwen Grice, really, it's great to hear from you. Maynor now, Gwen corrected. Do you regret that? Nicholas said, and Gwen blinked with surprise. I mean, now that he's gone and you're strapped with the name and have to decide to keep it or go back? Gwen started, but didn't know what to say. It's nice, I guess, having it match my daughter's. You have a kid? Yes, Whitney, she's 8. There was an awkward pause when Gwen expected Nicola to ask a follow-up about her daughter or inquire about others. No kids for you, she finally said, and then instantly worried she'd crossed the line asking about children. The issue was a hot button rather than the innocuous conversation she'd long thought it was. Her own pregnancy smooth and easy, although originally she and Todd thought they'd have more. He kept saying it wasn't the right time. He wanted to close one more business deal, launch one more app, get one more chance to hit it big first. Oh no, Nicholas said. Childless by choice. #. I want to be the fun auntie who spoils them rotten and shoves them back at their moms, pumped up on sugar. How old did you say? 8. My favorite age, Nicholas said, and Gwen appreciated how easily she was willing to smooth over Gwen's indelicate question, plus her awkwardness asking about Missy. Maybe Dayton made sense. Maybe she needed to be around family right now and away from all these memories. Thanks again, Gwen said as they got ready to hang up. She glanced at her watch, surprised to see they'd been on the phone for nearly half an hour. She was touched Nicola had been so generous with her time. Send me that resume, Nicola said. Gwen told her she'd send it by tomorrow, jotting down Nicola's email from the website. It's thin, Gwen warned her. At least something is, Nicola joked, and Gwen laughed again, finally recognizing what this felt like. The beginning of a friendship, one that had sidestepped those awful get-to-know-you coffees where you try to decide if you're really compatible or your children get along or if walking with the other woman in the morning would be better for your mental health than listening to a podcast. Maybe all those years she feared she was the dud to Todd's outgoing personality weren't really about being a dud at all, but about reaching a level of comfort where she could just be. She hung up the phone and opened a fresh Word document. She typed her name and Boulder address at the top and paused. She selected a better font and then another. What else went on a resume? What did she have to say? She hadn't worked in 10 years other than volunteering at the used book sale at Whitney School and some other school initiatives, which were mainly women in overpriced running gear talking about why they couldn't eat the pastries, even though each had brought a box. Still, she had nothing to lose, and with that, she did the best she could, filling in the gaps between her internship all those years ago and what brought her to this day. She composed an email to Nicola that she hoped was a blend of nepotism and professionalism and hit send. The laptop made the whoosh noise and Gwen leaned back, wondering what this feeling was. It took her a moment to recognize it. Accomplishment.
Oh, I love that.
That was a great passage.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was excellent. And I hope more readers engage and go get this book. Do you have any new projects you can tell us about? What's coming next for you?
I did just, like I was saying, I finished a draft of a novel and I'm so excited about it, but it's still in the bubble. Like it's still that piece where I'm like, I can't talk because I don't know what's going on, but I love it. I know that much.
So, oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, I'm hoping it'll all hold together. We were talking about revision. It's my favorite part, but it still feel on pins and needles till I get to that point where I'm like, I know this is going to hang together. And I'm not quite there yet.
Can you give some advice to new writers? What would you tell them? What would be the biggest piece of advice you could give?
I would say try to find the joy in your writing. I think that's something actually that new writers do almost instinctually. That's what draws them to it. But if you hold on to that as much as you can, I think that we sometimes get too caught up in feeling like, oh, negative about writing or something. And I love to remind myself there's joy in this. When I am working, I always say to my husband before I leave to go to the coffee shop, time to go to the playground. And so stay at the playground.
That's great.
Yeah, right. Set your intention that this is something you love and that's why you're doing it. Oh, wow. Wonderful.
Yes. And I should say, too, I don't always believe it. But I'm like, let's strive for it.
Like we're convincing ourselves. We have to convince ourselves.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for spending time with us today at BookTales. We really enjoy talking with you and having you read for us.
Thank you so much. This was a blast.
This was wonderful. And everyone, please order Erin's book, Come With Me, and be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the BookTales readings and drinks. Also, subscribe to this podcast, which releases once a month for more conversation with amazing authors. Thanks again for listening to BookTales. See you next time.